Hello, this is Barbara Peters, and I'm sitting actually in his kitchen with author David Morrell here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We've been friends for, good Lord, David, how long
has it been? It's at least 25 years.
We have. So we've been through quite a few facets of your ever-changing and flexible career.
And the book world, you know, everything goes around and around and around. It's been the changes that have occurred have been amazing.
They have been. And when you started, I mean, I love your origin story about, you know, being a professor, and then one day you wrote First Blood, and then off it went. Rambo, it's just never going to die. Is there going to be a new Rambo movie?
There is we're recording this in July of 2019, and there is going to be a fifth Rambo film in September called Rambo Last Blood. Now, whether or not that is in fact the case, it remains to be seen. I've talked to the CEO of Millennium Films, and they're still not sure. But in case they've set it up this way, the novel was published in 1972, and it took 10 years for the film to be made. So the book went along on its own way. It had been published in 30 languages and a lot of other good things that happened with it. And then this new incarnation in 1982 occurred. And for writers, especially beginning writers, it took me 3 years to write First Blood. I didn't know how to write a novel, and I was learning. And I had a wonderful teacher, Philip Klass is his name, but his pen name was William Tannen. I couldn't have done it without him. Also, Donald E. Westlake was of some help to me for mystery fans, crime fans. But there were days, you know, when I doubted, but finally it happened. And then the movie came out, and there were 26 attempts to make that movie, 26 scripts. At one time, Steve McQueen was Rambo. This was not fantasy. This was set up with Sidney Pollack directing. Two of my favorite film people, and Sidney told me this story, that they were set to shoot in 1975 when they realized that McQueen was in his mid-40s. And in 1975, there were no Vietnam veterans who were in their mid-40s. It was a young person's war. So two beginning producers, they were distributors learning how to produce, Andrew Vanya and Mario Casar, two guys I really loved. And they started a company called Carolco Pictures and sort of rewrote the way movies were done because of international sales. And anyhow, the film was a hit. And then they had, I don't know how to say this. The ending of the film was different to correspond with the ending of my novel. We'll leave it at that because some people get annoyed when I talk about the ending. I thought it was sort of common knowledge, but I guess it isn't. So anyway, the ending of the novel and the film were the same at one time, and audiences were very upset. So the producers decided to go back and reshoot the ending. And at that time, there was no intention of a sequel. They figured they'd be okay, you know, if it was a hit, which it really was. It was a huge, huge First Blood, a huge movie. And then they said, oh, my God, are we ever glad we changed the ending? Because now we can have sequels, which may, for the astute listener, indicate something about what I'm trying to hide here. So what isn't talked about is that the Rambo in my novel is an angry man who's just furious about what happened to him in Vietnam. He becomes, in the movie, a victim. It's a different kind of character, passive, leave me alone, woe is me, and then he gets upset. In the second film, suddenly he is jingoistic. He's exactly the reverse of the character in the first film. So in Rambo 2 and 3, we have a version of Rambo that is not the same as the guy in Rambo 1, is the First Blood. And then in the fourth film, which came out in 2007, and Sly called me one day and talked to me about this, he said he wasn't happy with how the second and third films glorified violence. So what he wanted to do in the fourth film was make it a Sam Peckinpah Rambo picture, where the violence would be aggressive and distant, you know, that we would say, oh my God, this is ugly. And he said, in this one, I'm going to try to get the tone of your novel, which we did not use in the movie. So I have no idea. I haven't seen a version of the fifth film. But this is a, you know, if we were in a university film class, this would be a lot of fun to try to track all these different Rambos. And then to make it all the more complicated and for me interesting is that I'm by contract am the only person who can write books about Rambo. So when they, and this goes back to a different time in the book market for Rambo 2 and 3, they, can we stop this a second?
So we're back after a short pause for a ringing telephone, and here we go. I was going to say that I think one of the remarkable things about the Rambo films is that you have kept the same guy. So, you know, he's lived a long time with you.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're talking about a franchise this long, I mean, you think about the, all the different James Bonds there have been or different Sherlock Holmes and all. I think it's remarkable that coming up on September, you have the same guy doing Rambo.
Yes. And you know, and just in a slightly different way, if someone pointed out to me that it, it's a unique character. We have Tarzan, we have Sherlock Holmes, we have James Bond, we have Rambo and Harry Potter in the 20th century, who went from books into films and became international action icons. And it's kind of daunting to think about that. But Sylvester takes care of himself. So someone was saying to me recently, oh, wait a minute, how old is he for the fifth film? He's 72. But I assure everyone that he is not going to be limping around, except as the character might suggest, that this is a, you know, very energetic action film from the I haven't seen the film, but I've seen elements of it. And what I was saying before the darn ringing occurred was for Rambo 2 and 3, I did novelizations. And because I had unusual freedom as the creator, the script for Rambo 2 was like 87 pages long and with a lot of white space, and literally had lines like, Rambo jumps up and shoots this guy, Rambo jumps up and shoots that guy. This, I'm serious. And I thought, I don't know what I could do with this, but James Cameron, the James Cameron of Titanic and Avatar fame, had done, when he wasn't James Cameron, so to speak, had done a version, a script for Rambo 2 that wasn't used. And I found out about it, and I said, I need to use this. So I got the shooting script for Rambo 2. I got the James Cameron script that wasn't used. And then I put in a third of my material. So the novelization for 2 and then 3 was, novelization for 3 was as complicated. These may be the most unique novelizations ever written that the author, who normally cannot change anything, was at liberty to change whatever the heck I wanted, as long as it sort of bore a resemblance to the film. So this was, it was a lot of fun.
You really think this is a film class, don't you?
I do. You know what I'm like.
I do know what you're like.
I just go on and on.
No, it's wonderful. I think you offer us insights that we wouldn't normally get. I don't know if you're free to talk about, but there are a couple of other film projects in the works for you for earlier books that may or may not come to fruition. Is serial television having an effect, do you think, on making, you know, turning books into film for you?
Yes. As you say, I can't talk a lot about I have Creepers, the Brotherhood of the Rose, and The Protector, and Testament. These are four other picked films that are in production, and not production, in development. And that's like, you know, like, I've been down this road so many times. At least two-thirds of my books have been optioned or sold at one time or another. And I don't... the heartbreak, Michael Douglas owns Extreme Denial, a novel of mine called Extreme Denial. He paid a very generous amount for this book, and his production company went out of business the next year. Nobody really knows who the rights belong to, maybe Paramount. And you know, that's going to be one of those that got away that really makes me unhappy. With the new streaming, which I see as a kind of crisis for books, there are currently, we have Amazon, we have Netflix, we have Hulu, and a few others, but if we put those three majors together, we have more than 500, it's hard to imagine this, 500 new scripted series.
Well, the good news is that it may get readers interested in some of your earlier books, you know?
Oh, it could be, you know, and I'm just thinking it, also generally that somebody might read, might watch a series and say, you know, I bet there's more to it, and might go to the books. So that's the hope, that they will migrate. And for me, it's not so much, yeah, naturally I want to have people reading my work, but in the larger sense, I see with four major streaming services starting next year, from Apple to Warner Brothers to NBC Universal to the fourth one will come to me, but these are Disney. I think we could easily soon have 800 scripted series. And, you know, who's with that much television, who can watch that much, will people be reading? It's a serious problem for me, at least.
It's unquestionably an issue for publishing and for writers, is that we're now competing with many other forms of entertainment. But, you know, at the heart of these, David, it's still stories.
Yes.
So I think we can adjust to that. Now, you and I have over the years had, I don't even know how many conversations about writing and publishing, some of them in your office.
Yes.
And one of the ones that I remember that I've always truly enjoyed was that you were working, I can't remember what book it was you were writing, but because of your contractual obligations to some characters that you have mm-hmm. written, you realized as you were writing this new book that you were perilously close to, in fact, writing this character that you're not allowed
yes.
to write again.
Yes.
And so your solution to it, which, do you remember this conversation?
No, keep going. I'm
okay.
loving it.
All right. Your solution to it was so incredibly elegant, which was that you went back and you changed the name. And when you changed the name, it changed the entire book for you.
That is true.
And I have made a point of talking to writers about this as a way, you know, if you're into a book and it's not working and so forth, I say, there's the David Morrell, you know, writer's guide thing here, yeah. which is that just changing the name
yes.
can seriously change the way you are seeing a character and writing a character.
And there's another way to do that. You're absolutely right. The book was The Fifth Profession, which is about protective agents, and that had sold to TriStar for a movie, and they decided not to make it. But there was built into the contract that the rights came back to me, but with an attachment that said that I had to pay not only what was paid to me initially, but also interest and overhead charges. And by the time this moved along and I was working on the next protective agent book, this is hard to imagine, but the overhead had now amounted to like $4 to $5 million, which made it no longer a book that anybody else would pick up. And so at that point I said, if I'm going to do this protective agent book, I need a new character. And then, I said, all right, let's see what happens if I change the name. And that, you know, what's in a name? And after all, if we use, I mean, it's just a bunch of syllables unless it's a name that refers to an object. But it's amazing how that changes perspective. And then there's a parallel way of looking at this. When I teach writing, I encourage people at the end of their first draft to change the font. To one that doesn't look like the one you're working on, and it's amazing how suddenly this is going to be a fresh book.
Yeah. Well, the name thing is really important. I won't mention who the author is, but my good friend and you know Thomas Perry, who I mm-hmm. think is one of the most brilliant plotters, a real capermeister. After Don Westlake died and Ross Thomas died, I think Tom is the guy writing you know, the capers at the moment. Anyway, he was kind enough to read a manuscript I sent him for Poison Pen Press, and when it came back, he had written a very nice blurb, but he also wrote a little editorial letter to me, and he said that the only thing he didn't like in the book was the name of the character.
Okay.
And I don't want to say it because
yes,
you know, that wouldn't
course.
Be fair. But the problem, of course, was that this is book six, and you know you can't really go back,
yeah,
you know,
that's right.
and rename a character. But he went on at some length about why naming characters is so important, and you think about, you know, Reacher,
right.
or, you know, these iconic names. And,
or Rambo.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, as you know, came from the name of an apple. My wife was out, this is when we were very young, and I was in school, and my wife happened to be driving where they were selling apples at the side of the road, and she bought some, brought them home, and I'm writing in the First Blood, but I had no name for the character, except I knew it. He needed the name of kind of force to the name, and she said, "Eat this apple," and I said, "I'm writing, no, eat the apple." So I bit into the apple just to get it all done with, and said, "Hey, that's pretty good. What's it called?" And she said, "It's a Rambo apple," which is a famous apple in central Pennsylvania where we were then living. And ta-da, so, you know, my wife and the name of an apple. So a name can make a big difference. And just to on the lowest level, remembering that many books will be converted into audio books. I have a thing about S's in names. So you will never get me using the name Susan in a novel, because Susan said... will be agony for that poor narrator. So I tend to, it's very seldom you'll see me using an S in a name, just to be kind to the narrator.
That's something you and I haven't discussed, but I'm tucking that away. So Nate, you're really well known for your action adventure, The Brotherhood of the Rose was like an early, you know, different Da Vinci Code and so forth. But some years ago, when I was here in Santa Fe, you were working on a new project, yes. And you gave me a manuscript, which I took home and read. And in my usual way, when reading, took my red pen and wrote all over it.
Yes.
But it was a Victorian book and went on to be a trilogy. So what got you interested in Thomas De Quincey and writing three crime novels about this real Victorian person?
When I started, I was thinking of a career and what one could do to last a long time. And... I had perceived, this doesn't seem to be an issue anymore, but there was a time when if a writer stayed writing the same kind of novel, after about 15 years, readers got tired and writers got tired. That has not been the case recently, but it was my perception that what I was on was excuse the cliche, a journey. And that I was evolving, and I could have gone on writing outdoor action for the rest of my career. Whether anybody would be reading them now is another matter. And so I had evolved into writing spy novels with The Brotherhood of the Rose, which was the first, may have been, I'm pretty sure it was the first book to combine the British and the American spy novel traditions. It was a place. And I did some other things, and then, as you know, but it's maybe worth talking about, in 2009, my granddaughter Natalie died from a rare bone cancer called Ewing sarcoma. She was 14, and this was doubly horrifying because our son Matthew had died from the same rare disease when he was 15, and when I say rare, only about 200 people get it each year in the United States, and it's a bad disease. So I was looking to find a way to escape. And I had watched a movie about Charles Darwin's nervous breakdown when he was writing on The Origin of Species. And his daughter had died, and the breakdown was preventing him from, understandably, from moving forward, and nobody could figure out what was wrong with him. Now it's pretty obvious, but in the movie, a character comes to talk to him, and the character is a messenger, basically a messenger, and says, "You know, Charles, there are people like Thomas De Quincey who say that we can be affected by, controlled by, thoughts and emotions we do not know we have." And now that's Freud, but we're talking about the 1850s, and I thought, who the hell is Thomas De Quincey? And is this true? And then I started down the rabbit hole. So I began learning about De Quincey, and in fact, he had invented Freudianism, so to speak, the subconscious, half century before Freud. And I thought this would be cool to write a novel about this man who would be working with newly founded Scotland Yard's Detective Division, who are happy to have plaster casts of footprints. And here's this madman who's 4'11" tall, who's an opium addict, and is talking to them about the chasms and abysses of the human mind. And I just thought that contrast was wonderful. And you come into this story, as you know, because in the story, there is he had in real life a daughter named Emily, and she was 21 at the time that I sent the book. And she was sort of his caretaker. All the rest of the kids had run. He was too much. He was a handful. And it was because of Emily, in talking about the subconscious, it was because of Emily that I think I wrote the books. So one day I'm in your store, The Poison Pen in Scottsdale, and you were talking to me. We were in front of a nice group of people, and we were talking about this and that, and you just blindsided me when you said, well, of course you know that Emily is your version of your dead granddaughter. And I remember feeling my heart stop, and you were yes, of course. That was the drive for me to write those books. And I showed you, the first one was called Murder is a Fine Art, and you said, hey, I think it's a trilogy, and I really loved that world. So I did, in fact, write two more, Inspector of the Dead and Ruler of the Night, and I got really, you know, the response was great. You know, people initially said, whoa, Rambo's creator in Victorian England, but the response was really terrific. And I think in a way that as an escape from grief to be on those, what I call those harrowing fog-bound streets, was healthy for me in the long run.
Well, I think it was. Actually, I think you and your wife, Donna, are truly remarkable that you have survived two real tragedies without falling apart. You know, death of a child is the most traumatic thing that can happen to parents and to a couple.
We saw many marriages fall apart in the cancer wards. It's odd how this happens, because our view, and God knows I grieved at a different rate than Donna did, and it took a lot of, you know, me understanding where she was and her understanding where I was, and this is over years before we sort of were at the same spot. But we saw couples. God bless them. I mean, this is painful, but God bless them. We saw couples who could not grieve together.
Yeah.
And the marriages split up, and you know, God bless them. I know how hard it is, and you know, there's no right way in anything, and it just, you know, added to the pain for them. But I thank you for that. We worked real hard to have respect for each other after that. Not to inflict ever any pain on one another unintentionally, we'd never do it deliberately, that would, you know, just add to the anguish that we were going through.
Well, you've survived a remarkable life, and I don't think that we want to go all the way back to your own difficult childhood. I sometimes wonder, though, you know, you laugh about being Canadian and being polite and all, but, you know, you two were raised in a caretaking, civil, and
yes,
protective environment, which I think has stood you in very good stead over the course of all these years that I've known you.
It was not a happy childhood. Graham Greene, I love to quote him, said an unhappy childhood is a gold mine for a writer. And my father had died in combat. My mother, who was a gifted seamstress, and made clothing for people at a time when you couldn't buy decent clothing in a store unless you were paying an extreme amount of money, a woman's dress, for example. So, but she couldn't do her work and take care of me, so she was forced to put me in an orphanage. And so when I was two or three, I was in this orphanage, and it wasn't quite explained to me what the heck was going on. All of a sudden she was gone, and I was in this strange place, which I really never got over. And then for a time, I lived on a Mennonite farm. My mother took me out of the orphanage and put me on a Mennonite farm for a year, and that was very interesting. The fellow, Wilfred Shantz, and Wilfred is the name I used for Wilfred Teasel in First Blood, the police chief, kind of autocratic, because Wilfred Shantz, and I respect the guy, but he had a thing about eating and chewing, and people had to chew their food. So at the age of three or four, I learned how to count to 50, because that was how much I had to chew before I could swallow. And we had lunch today, and I was the last one. Everybody else was done into the dessert, and I'm still manfully going through my food.
I have learned to pace myself when I go out to eat with you. There is no question about it. David, it's always such a pleasure to talk to you. I know that you've been involved recently in, you know, wildlife shelter in Santa Fe and so forth, but, you know, are you working on anything at all, or are you still kind of in a bit of a break?
I haven't published anything since 2016. So why is that? One reason is that I am desperately confused about what's happening in the United States. And we're not going to talk politics. I think anybody anywhere, I don't care what persuasion they have, would understand that there's confusion going on. So I am sort of unmoored. And also, I was so at peace with 1850s London. I mean, as tortured and terrible a time. I mean, oh God, you know, the terrible things that happened there in real life that I managed to get in the books. In spite of that, I felt really at peace. I find that I'm confused about what's happening in the book world. There's a gender dominance at the moment where women writers, and hooray for women writers, or women-driven stories. And it may be that I just haven't found the right kind. I never chased the market, so that whatever the books I've been, and I have been working, it's just that the books I've been writing do not seem to fit a market in which the woman in this, the woman in that, the girl on that, the girl on this, as an example of gender in publishing, it just doesn't fit with what's being published. So I'm sort of amassing material, writing short stories, writing magazine articles, and one of these days, I hope to have something done so that when another cycle starts, that I'll then have a book that I think would be welcomed, as opposed to one that, you know, reviewers might not understand how it fit in the current trends that are happening.
You just did have a collection of stories published by Subterranean Press. So
yes.
I was very happy to see that. And knowing you and knowing that writing is who you are,
yes,
I'm pretty sure that at some point, you know, something is going to laser in and focus you on
pages galore. It's just a question of saying, maybe I'll become J.D. Salinger without meaning to compare. You know, maybe when they find me mossed over my desk, they'll say, oh, look at all the books he wrote. You know, it's hard to say, but a writer shouldn't be confused when sitting down to write a novel. The theme and the people that I'm writing for should be very clear in my mind. And I don't know. I just it's very baffling to me that this happened. But I am working. It's just that I'm trying to find that focus that I think that people will welcome.
Well, I think on that note, I'm going to say thank you very much for talking to me.
Good to chat with you, Barbara.